Hi, everyone. This is Holly Herndon.
I'm Matt Dryhurst.
And you're listening to
Interdependence.
Welcome to the Interdependence Podcast, where we host conversations with some of the people we think are shaping 21st century culture. You're listening to the free version of this podcast. If you would like to hear the full version and support this series, please visit patreon.com/interdependence. This podcast is ad-free and only possible through patron support. Thank you. Ring, ring, ring. Hi.
Hi, Union of Musicians and Allied Workers.
Hi, Matt. How are you doing?
Pretty good. I guess it would be nice. We normally ask for people to introduce themselves. Would you mind introducing yourselves as individuals and then as the group that you represent or the groups that you represent?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Joey DeFrancesco. I'm a musician and organizer in the United States. I play in bands La Neve and Downtown Boys, and I'm one of the organizers with the Union of Musicians and Allied Workers, which is a new organization started this year trying to organize mostly independent musicians to take power back in the music industry.
Wonderful.
Very cool.
Yeah, and I'm Mary Regalado. I play in Downtown Boys, Gauche, and Clear Channel. I'm a musician and also an organizer with the Union of Musicians and Allied Workers.
Wonderful.
Awesome.
And are you both in Rhode Island?
No, I'm in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and wonderful. I'm in Providence.
Sounds lovely. Great. Sounds cold.
Right now, it's a lovely sunny day, but yeah, it's getting grim.
It's that time of year.
Wonderful. So, I mean, I guess to start out, I'm really curious maybe to learn a bit about the backstory of you all putting this organization together. You know, how far back does this go? We're going to talk a little bit about some of the more recent initiatives. But yeah, where did this idea come from?
I think a lot of musicians in the U.S. had ideas of starting a union for many years. We have some existing musicians unions here, like the AFM, the American Federation of Musicians, like SAG-AFTRA represents some musicians. Yahtzee represents, like, you know, music workers, like stagehands, these sorts of things. And we support the work that all of those groups do, but all of them were cutting out the vast majority of working musicians today, who are musicians who don't have like a single employer of a theater company or something like that, but yep, make money touring between, you know, three or four record companies, between a bunch of streaming platforms, you know. And so there's a need for this kind of organization to exist. There had been some groups of musicians taking collective actions, kind of functioning like a union previously. I usually go back to 2017 to explain some of this formation, when a group of musicians put out a collective statement against South by Southwest in protest, mm-hmm, of their an immigration policy. They had another contract where they were threatening to work with ICE to deport foreign musicians who broke South by Southwest's contract. And this collective of musicians who put out this statement succeeded in getting South by Southwest to remove this contract. So there's this example in the near past of how independent musicians, when working collectively, actually had an enormous amount of power to change policy in one of the biggest festivals in the world, right? So this kind of like center group of people continue to do some actions over the next couple years, including starting a campaign called No Music for ICE, which was a solidarity campaign. There had been all these immigrant right groups calling for boycotts of Amazon for their collaboration with ICE and with deportations and like family separation policies in the United States. So we were putting that together in 2019. And then a lot of that core group came together again in March when COVID began and everything immediately got shut down. And all of us as musicians, as we're sure going to talk about more, we're kind of like, oh shit, you know, we make most of, if not all of our money at this point touring. That's totally removed. It is time we get together and demand a bigger cut of all of this other money that's existing in this industry and unite as workers to join with other workers. So we all started emailing each other and talking. And the first thing we put together was a list of COVID relief demands, joining with other groups of workers and unions across the United States to demand relief, medical relief, direct financial relief, unemployment assistance from the U.S. government. And so we were acting collectively as musicians to join with other collectively organized workers to push on the government for these demands. Sort of out of there, we were then like, hey, we should keep this going, and then eventually formed UMass shortly after out of that group working on those COVID demands. And we've come up with a number of different campaigns since then, but that was really the beginning.
Awesome. Just for and also for the benefit, because the name of the organization I think is compelling and interesting, mostly because of the allied workers part, right? Like, would you mind explaining a little bit more who would maybe constitute allied workers in this context?
Yeah, for sure. Venue workers, sound engineers, promoters and bookers, basically anyone that works in the music industry that isn't a musician is welcome to join UMA.
Yeah, and that came directly out of COVID too, because it very clearly showed how we all have shared interests, that workers at venues suddenly were just as out of work as musicians. So, you know, it seemed like, yeah, we were going to be stronger together and had a lot of shared interest in this fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I noticed earlier that Heba Kadri, who mastered our last album, was tweeting something about the organization, specifically her interest in, you know, sound engineers, mastering engineers often getting kind of left out of these discussions.
Yeah, so she was tweeting yesterday, I think, directly in relation to our Spotify campaign. And in an article that came actually in South Africa that was sort of alarmingly writing how the journalist had difficulty finding musicians to comment in the article because so many musicians were afraid of retaliation from Spotify, and so were refusing to or fearful of commenting in the article. She was engaging with that, and yeah, making that connection that you know, without musicians, and particularly without independent musicians, like people outside of these small number of people the major labels are paying, engineers, producers, mastering people are also out of work. So yeah, she was directly making that connection to the kind of like allied workers bit of it.
That's really interesting. Also, I feel like platforms like Spotify, they almost kind of erase the names of people like Heba, who, you know, who really is kind of like the last step in the process to make the track sound, you know, to its fullest potential. But like, if you wanted to go on Spotify and look for all of the works that she's mastered, I don't think you could even search.
You certainly couldn't. In fact, I believe it was a demand that you made of Spotify. So maybe let's talk a little bit about that and get like the high level, like the basic information out of the way of around your Spotify campaign, because it would also be really interesting, I think, to talk about this idea of, you know, of fears that people might have in terms of speaking out on this issue. So you all organized, and I believe there's almost 20,000 signatures around this petition that you made towards Spotify. Would you mind giving us like an overview of what exactly that was?
Yeah. So we had a few demands for Spotify. It was around paying artists fairly, for Spotify to show transparency, especially when it comes to things like payola and closed door deals with major labels. We were also asking for all labor to be credited on all recordings, which includes mixing, mastering, recording, and to end all legal battles with artists.
Wonderful. And yeah, so these demands, you publish these demands. You got a ton of signatures toward these demands. Did you, by any chance, I saw there was a great deal of publicity around this. Did you receive any response from anyone at Spotify?
No, Spotify still hasn't commented.
Yeah, we've had, as you said, there's been press throughout tech media, music media, in a number of countries at this point, and have a number of high-level journalists requesting comment from Spotify who have just refused to answer any journalist requests. So it seems like their strategy at this point is simply to ignore that this is happening, which I think is generally policy for a number of companies when first confronted with the campaign, is to simply hope it's going to go away. We're of course just getting started with it. So we haven't got a response from Spotify yet, but it's fairly certain they know it's happening.
And can I just ask what your full strategy is? I mean, I understand that getting thousands of signatures, you get a lot of people on board, you get like social media kind of invested, like groups on social media, you get press around it. What's kind of what's the kind of campaign strategy?
Yeah, so this is the very beginning of the campaign. We're certainly not just putting up an online petition and getting signatures on it. I think this in and of itself has been quite effective, right? This has created an enormous amount of debate and talk, and I think has worked well in conjunction with, like, you know, the Broken Record campaign and the investigation that's going on right now in the UK. But it's like any other labor campaign. This is how we're thinking about it. You announce your demands, get a lot of people organized into working with your demands, and then you escalate from there. So, for instance, this month we were planning on delivering, in fact, these petitions to Spotify offices simultaneously in different cities. We postponed this because the COVID situation has spiked so bad right now in the United States and elsewhere. So we're called off the in-person delivery, but that's something we are going to do fairly soon when we're able to safely, even a socially distanced petition delivery. But this is an extremely exciting thing. This campaign, as far as I know, is the first really large-scale organized campaign against a streaming platform trying to build collective musician power against the streaming platform, and to do these in-person deliveries, as far as I know, again, will be the first time of any kind of like collective real life action against a streaming company led by musicians. So these are really exciting steps as well. I don't think I can totally lay out our like entire strategy, but there's other points too, right? You just want to continue to build pressure on the company, like in any other labor campaign. So we're also pursuing, for instance, political strategies. So things like what's happening in the UK, I think very well could and should happen in the United States, because it's clear there needs to be an inquiry in the US around how streaming is operating right now, especially in light of some recent congressional inquiries into, for instance, antitrust practices in Facebook and Google. I think a lot of those principles could also apply to Spotify and these other music companies that are approaching monopoly status. We're looking at these public pressure, worker organizing, doing in real life stuff, as well as this political strategy. So there's a lot of steps and we're just getting started with it.
Wonderful. Well, maybe it's going to be useful for those who aren't familiar to maybe dive deep into some of the demands. I have my own questions about kind of each of them, actually. I've taken kind of like five or six, I think the most prominent that you displayed on the website. So one of the demands you have here is pay musicians at least 1 cent per stream. Let's talk about that. And I'll qualify. So as I come across fully transparent here, in reading many of the demands, my initial feeling was that one of the most kind of clever things about the demands, in a sense, is that many of them are kind of impossible for the streaming service to deliver, with the exception of maybe the crediting all labor and recordings part. And the reason I think that's clever is, number one, like the first thing that occurs to me when I think about that is that, you know, if you're gathering a lot of publicity and a lot of kind of collective eyes and potential action around something like this, the next question is to ask, well, why can't a streaming service pay 1 cent per stream? And what if some other kind of potentially collectively owned service were to pay something equivalent or far more commensurate with that number? But I wonder. So maybe let's start on the per stream payment. You know, what's the motivation first off behind that, and how did you come to that number? Is it a symbolic number?
I was going to say the motivation behind that demand is just because the royalty rates that we're giving right now are so minuscule. We were trying to aim for a number that is doable by Spotify's model, but also something that could give us like something that resembles a living wage.
Yep.
Yeah. And I think it has the advantage of being a clear demand that is easy to understand and easy to organize people around, right? You know, I understand the arguments that, you know, this is not how Spotify's existing model works. Why are you asking for this? You know, in our demand, we address that, right? The direct text is, many claim that such wages are not compatible with Spotify's current economic system. Our demand is that this model be adjusted so that ours can be paid fairly. If Spotify's model can't pay artists fairly, it shouldn't exist, right? So this does go to your point, right? That this entails fundamentally changing a lot of aspects of Spotify's model, which is what we're asking for, and we think can be done, right? If workers at Walmart are asking for $15 an hour, it's not, I don't think, important to get bogged down in understanding every tiny detail of Walmart's supply chain and business model. It's enough to know that Walmart makes billions and billions and billions of dollars, creates some of the wealthiest people in the world, and that they can and should pay workers. And the onus is on Walmart to figure out how to do that. Saying $15 an hour, right, you can organize people, right? It's a way to get people excited about the campaign. The slogan is not, you know, okay, $15 in New York City where wages are high, where cost of living is higher, but $12 an hour in Kansas where cost of living is low. No, it's $15 an hour, and that's the floor. That's the starting point, and then you can figure out the details. Mm-hmm. But it's the clear, comprehensible demand that gets people excited. And I think, you know, the success of this campaign so far speaks to that.
So is this something that you're also taking to some of the other streaming platforms? Like, I guess YouTube's probably the worst, right? But there's also Apple and Tidal, and I guess none of them are really at the 1 cent per stream valuation. Are you kind of starting with Spotify and then you plan to expand from there? Or is this a criticism you have for all streaming across the board?
I think it exists for all streaming across the board. Like you say, that they're all operating on a broken model, and there's fundamental issues with just how royalties operate. And that, you know, YouTube obviously dramatically drives down these streaming royalties. But I think, you know, in terms of our capacity right now, we are focusing on Spotify. I think it's what makes sense for running a public campaign. There's an enormous amount of anger at Spotify in particular that I think it's important to work with, right? That is the workplace people see themselves as being part of, and you organize in your workplace, and that's what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And you know, they're the market leader in streaming, so that's where we're beginning this campaign. But obviously, you know, everything we're asking for applies to all of these streaming companies, and I think it's great for it's that the UK investigation is looking at streaming as a whole.
Yeah, and when we came up with the 1 cent per stream, we were using like Tidal and Apple Music because they pay closer to 1 cent. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's how we decided to target Spotify with the 1 cent too.
Great. And then so another demand you have here is pushing for, and I know that the Broken Record campaign, we had Tom Gray on here earlier a couple of months ago, who is very enthusiastic about a user-centric payment model. Do you maybe want to explain, you know, what that is for those who aren't familiar, and why you chose to include it in your demands?
Yeah, so most of these demands are in fact coming from other ideas people have had before. So that idea of the user-centric model is directly coming from the UK Musicians Union and Tom Gray campaign that was focused on this. And yeah, people who don't know, user-centric model is the idea of switching to streaming payments, whereby artists directly get paid for the streams that they receive. In other words, like if you play a stream on Spotify, the artist would get, you know, 1 cent in our model. Yep. Paid directly, which a lot of people, I think, believe is how it operates. In reality, it's this pro rata model where all of the money from the streaming service gets pooled into an enormous sum and then distributed out proportionally to artists based on their share of streams. So some people argue this would not make too much of a difference, this switch. Mm-hmm. I do find it compelling. I think for independent artists, it could have a benefit. And I think conceptually, there's a great benefit because it allows us to do things like negotiate higher royalty rates more easily because it is a, you know, one-for-one payment per stream situation. Mm-hmm. And it conceptually removes the kind of more, I think, increased competition inherent in the pro rata model, whereby, you know, if a Lady Gaga is growing faster proportionally to a smaller artist, they're going to end up getting a bigger share, and your relative wage is going to decrease. We know that is the trend in the music industry. So I think it's a worthwhile demand, even though some people can question like how much impact. I think it works with as a part of a host of changes.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder. I mean, my question on this, and again, I'll preface all of this by saying I think that, you know, making these demands and addressing people where they're at currently, right, which is most people, for better or worse, are tied into or locked into these kind of streaming models, particularly on the consumer side of things. It makes a lot of sense to make these demands and propose things. And I think that, yeah, I mean, in a scenario in which we are inevitably locked into streaming services, it makes the user-centric model makes way more sense. The challenge I have, or at least I think it's an interesting question to ask here, is, you know, let's presuppose that artists are being paid at least 1 cent per stream under a user-centric payment model. The more successful those demands are, how much does it start looking like buying the album?
Sorry, can you say that question again? I'm not sure I totally followed.
So it's like, I mean, the issue for me, so okay, I'll come fully clean on this. And I think I shared these comments actually with an email from the group before, and I've shared similar comments to Tom with Broken Record before, in a sense, right? Mm-hmm. Is that you kind of have like there's a chicken and egg problem, right? On the one hand, streaming has kind of dominated the popular consciousness as being the solution to the music industry, right? So when most people think about the inevitable future of experiencing music online or even still like providing a living for musicians online, they inevitably default to thinking, okay, well, on-demand streaming is what's gonna happen. How do we subdivide this in such a way so as to make it more equitable and more profitable for smaller artists? The challenge I have is, in a sense, when I look at these demands, I see like 1 cent per stream and that money going directly to the person you want it to, right? I wonder how many you know, you're talking about if you stream something 100 times, that means that you're paying $1 direct to the artist who you're listening to. How much could we sidestep the entire streaming conversation? What appears to be coming into sharp focus here is that the streaming model, it fundamentally kind of doesn't work, like, or the per play valuation model fundamentally doesn't work. And we have this other kind of model through, say, a Bandcamp or whatever, where people are directly supporting artists owning something, not having to negotiate kind of hypothetical per stream calculations. So I wonder, like, when you meet these demands, does the acquisition of an album start looking like an innovation again? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, it's a good question, right? So why focus this energy on extracting concessions from Spotify when the energy could be spent promoting an entirely different model, like, for example, the Bandcamp model? I think both things can be done simultaneously. I don't think it's one or the other, all, right? I think we all actively promote, you know, like the Bandcamp days, you know, that's been huge for artists, particularly during COVID. you know, where Bandcamp's waiving the revenues, and you know, artists have been gaining significant income from Bandcamp during the pandemic. But you know, it is an unfortunate reality that streaming is dominating, and the sort of monopoly structure currently of Spotify just commanding so much of this universe of music consumption, I think means that it can't, you know, it's not going to go away on its own, and it needs to be confronted head on. And I think whatever your goal is, whether it's to extract concessions for Spotify or move people to other models, the beginning and the only real way you do that is by organizing huge numbers of artists, and building power collectively amongst huge numbers of artists. So I'm coming from a labor organizing background. You know, I used to work in a hotel, and work to, you know, build a union in the hotel, and then worked with the hotel workers union for a while. I'm also an organizer with the teachers union currently, in my other life, right now. And in that context, you know, if you're in your workplace, that is, you know, the hotel, and you're trying to organize your coworker to, you know, come out on a picket line or sign a union card or whatever it is, the beginning of your conversation is not, you know, hey, wouldn't it be better if instead of, you know, working to make money for our bosses, we, you know, started our own cooperatively owned hotel and like totally reframe this whole thing. Right. You start with what's right in front of you. You start with like, hey, it sucks we're getting paid this wage. It sucks that the manager is singling you out to work these terrible shifts and do like close opens and all of this stuff. And you work to extract demands from, extract concessions from capital and from companies in this way. And that's how you build power and get people organized. I think we need to think of music in a similar way, right? This Spotify is the reality of our workplace right now. It's where all musicians are. And I think we need to target it. We need to target where the capital is and target where the power is, in order to build our own collective power to, you know, extract more resources from Spotify and these sorts of platforms. And then when you have that power, I think you can then are better situated to do things like move people to better models and to better platforms.
That's really smart. Yeah, that seems like a really kind of like pragmatic strategy. And Spotify in a way is kind of like the perfect opponent in a way, because they're so unlikable. Yeah. And just some of the kind of comments that their team come out and say to musicians, it seems like a really smart strategy to kind of organize musicians across the board who might come from entirely different backgrounds or entirely different scenes, can all kind of join forces and say like, Spotify sucks, how can we do something about this, and then start organizing from that point. That's a really good idea.
Yeah, everybody hates them, and you know, Daniel Ek has so much of the music industry is this kind of like faceless evil thing in the background, but Daniel Ek really seems intent on making himself like a singularly hated figure, which I think is great for our organizing, right? It helps to have like an evil boss who's just telling everyone to work harder all the time. So
that's really funny.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, the concern I have, at least maybe let's say with something like the user-centric payment model, and I said this to Tom too, is like one issue I have with it in a way is, right, so the first challenge with any of this, which I completely commend you all for addressing and succeeding at, is just simply communicating to a large group of people that there's a problem here, right? Because I think that, and I think Tom and Broken Record and Ivers have also been doing a lot of work petitioning people, asking them, and just kind of testing the water to see how aware people are of the fact that, you know, their music isn't really benefiting the bottom line for the people, the artists they tend to care about or they claim to care about. And so in that sense, it's actually, it's really, really useful as kind of like as a means of instructing people that, you know, musicians are unhappy. And I completely agree with you,
in your assessment that, you know, COVID has really accelerated this conversation, right? It's been something that's been bubbling for a few years, and it's really encouraging to see. It kind of got to a point whereby it couldn't be ignored anymore, right? The challenge I have with user-centric, for example, though, is I wonder that when you get opportunities to concentrate and focus people's interest on this particular topic, you know, user-centric, which ultimately is an untested idea, right? Because one of the main challenges with user-centric ultimately is most of these demands, and most demands that I hear in that particular universe, aren't really, outside of the Paola stuff, to be honest, but like, and the closed door contracts, they aren't really addressing like the discoverability problem, right? Because the other great challenge with these centralized opaque streaming services is that even though hypothetically you can play your place your music on there, it doesn't mean anyone's going to end up finding it. And we've already seen, actually, I mean, given this kind of pantomime villain role that Spotify's playing, you know, over the course of COVID, their announcement that they were going to start offering beneficial placement to those who charged even less per stream definitely kind of creates an even more of a caricature of the like the Darth Vader figure looking to kind of drive down prices and subjugate people more. The challenge I have with user-centric payments, in a sense, is that does that then become a new narrative to make consumers feel better about a model that is fundamentally not going to deliver the kind of living wage standard that I'm sure we're all, you know, we all agree it should be the goal here. You know, what happens if Spotify does find a way to maybe even create like an indie tier, right? Where it's like, okay, cool, we're going to have the commercial radio model over here. Then over here, we're going to generate this indie tier where we compensate people better under a user-centric model. You know, what if that doesn't work? Do you see where I'm getting at here? It's like my main issue is, it's a two-sided sword. It's a double-edged sword. I see the benefit of approaching people where they're at. The other perspective I have is, what ends up happening? Are we just further centering an idea that that we've demonstrated doesn't work?
Yeah, I don't think in and of itself the user-centric pay model is going to be a solution. And I agree with you. I think and some people have put undue focus on it as sort of the central issue here, and imagining that shift alone will totally reframe things. Because as you said, you know, so much of the problem is like playlisting these algorithms and secretive editorial decisions at Spotify that, you know, we know major labels are all in on, and has had the effect of driving an even higher percentage of music industry revenue to the very top 0.001% of artists. So yeah, I don't think the user-centric model on its own is going to fix anything. But I mean, that's why we have a number of demands here, right? We think no one of these things is going to solve the issue. And are kind of throwing all of these things at it again, you know, to come back to that text, right? If Spotify's model can't pay artists fairly, it shouldn't exist, right? So I think we're looking for these kind of fundamental changes, and the user-centric model, I think, can be one part of that. But I fully agree with you. It's not, you know, it's not going to fix Spotify. And yeah, you know, there's a danger that focusing too much on it, you know, allows them a cheap out, right? They can say, "Oh, we did your thing, you know, shut up now." But it you know, that's not really the focus of our campaign. So yeah,
totally. And that's the thing. I mean, I'm being what's the word? Like, I'm being finicky on this stuff more for the listener and less to communicate. You know, I support what y'all are doing. I think that my big nightmare scenario, though, for example, is that, you know, one of them, I believe Deezer has been experimenting with a user-centric model, you know, as potentially as a competitive distinction, right? Because now, I mean, there's, as you say, there's been like discontent bubbling up around Spotify. You have all these different streaming services. One or two of them, as Tidal already attempted to do, although they kind of failed on the Paola part famously, right? You know, there's going to be competition now for people to kind of signal their allegiance to certain kinds of artists and frame themselves as being kind of more artist focused. And my only worry ultimately is that on the consumer side, who are obviously really difficult to educate about this kind of thing, there'll be somebody who's completely unfamiliar with these ideas in a couple of years' time saying, well, you know, the $10 I pay a month to support artists is going to the right people. And I'm participating in fair trade streaming when in actuality, you know, $10 a month distributed amongst God knows how many artists that you play on demand, you know, the numbers might not get us any closer to the kind of living wage conditions that ultimately we're all looking for.
Well, the fundamental question might be, you know, do you need to pay more than $10 a month to have access to a global archive of music?
Well, that is one of the conceits of streaming, yeah, right? Exactly. Is this idea of saying, okay, well, you know, we have this kind of like this illusory history with piracy that allegedly everybody in the world had the time and the means to download everything at will, which was kind of an overblown statement pushed by the majors at the time. So now what we have to do is the next best thing we can do is to basically give everybody access to everything at this low price. And I'm very skeptical personally that any kind, you know, unless the catalog was shrunk down to a really, really small number of artists, you know, that a culture of people paying $10 a month for culture is going to ultimately provide living wages for many artists.
But it's one thing to demand Spotify to just close because they're fundamentally a flawed business. It's another thing to demand this list of things and then take it from there and see where you go next. Seems to be their more pragmatic approach.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, we're just...
Right, exactly. I think it's, I feel like for years now, we've in the industry, been having this conversation, and I think it's good to have these conversations and think about what should this ideally look like. At some point, I think though, it's like we just have to make an incision somewhere and start like punching into it and like building our power out of that. And there's a fundamental issue in any labor organizing, right? Do you take the bits thrown to you to satisfy your demands, right? If you're demanding $20 an hour, do you take a $1 wage increase to $17 an hour, whatever it is, right? But it's still a victory, and you have to organize and like get it moving, even if you're risking those sorts of things. And I think, you know, if we won, for instance, a user-centric model, yeah, there's the risk that people would be satisfied with the reform and shut up about it. There's also a potential that you would have had hundreds of thousands of musicians taking collective action and seeing it works and then going, oh shit, we have power. We have a seat at the table here. Like, what else can we do?
Yep. Mm-hmm. I agree. And that last point I think is because as you say, in terms of making an incision, I think you've been very successful in doing that. And that to me ultimately is the one remarkable accomplishment here, I think, is that with any hope, this number of people, and I'm sure that number will grow, feeling like they do have a voice in these circumstances, that incision fundamentally makes ideas that personally I'm more excited about that more feasible, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
So how did you all handle outreach and get so many people interested and involved and across a kind of like broad, inclusive spectrum of musicians?
I think it was just like a lot of work. Like, we would have kind of phone banks on Zoom where we'd all reach out to people that we know and people that they know, and reach out to people that were interested in No Music for Ice and that had signed on to our COVID demands, and just maintaining those contacts with musicians and allied workers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just doing organizing. And I think this is the piece that's been missing is, for a while, I think we've been under illusion that we can make the change just by, so the analysis is important, but solely by having the analysis, or that it's going to like pick up and go viral online and then just sort of like happen. But Mary said, just doing kind of hardcore labor political organizing, like texting a few thousand people and telling them to sign something and to share it around and to get those mm-hmm. signatures going. That's how we build power.
When we were like working on collecting signatures before we went public with it. So when we first started, when we went public with it, we had about 600 signatures already. Mm-hmm. So then it was easier to, once we went public with those names and those people boosting the campaign.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I mean, it's also, I mean, as fraught a time as it is, it's also kind of maybe an ideal time for people to start, you know, because I feel like, and actually I do want to talk about this more given the wonderful opportunity that we have four musicians on a call about this. But you get the impression that, you know, this is something that exactly has lingered around for a long time as And the opportunity of COVID in the sense where people have the time in between their multiple jobs to actually think about this stuff and think about what they might want to do about it, I'm sure probably advantage this too.
Yeah, absolutely. And it has thrown into relief how ridiculous Spotify's system is. I think a lot of us, when we were touring, we were making our income from touring and almost, you know, we're angry at Spotify, but almost thought of it as like sort of a, you know, it was just like a tool. Like, you knew you weren't going to make money off of it, but you put your music up there and hope you got on the playlist and stuff because it would sell tickets to your shows and everything. But now that touring's gone, everyone was like, oh, Christ, like, no, I should be getting compensated for this. Like, Spotify's valuation keeps going up. It's like, you know, $60 billion or something now. And I'm, you know, all musicians are having trouble making their rent payments all over the place. So it's throwing that into stark relief. But yeah, just being home and having the time to organize has been huge as well. And has also fostered a community. Like, it's, you know, there's that aspect of labor organizing too, where it's just like all these people I used to see on tour, you know, every few months. Now I get, you know, see on a Zoom call every week or two, which is not exactly the same, but it, like, there's a certain continuity to the community that's been important to maintain through COVID.
Yeah.
Cool.
I'm really interested in what you mentioned earlier, that a publication in South Africa was having a hard time getting anyone to speak out on these issues. Would you mind talking more about this? And have you had similar experiences? Have you encountered people who were concerned in leveling criticisms toward these platforms?
And have you found yourselves removed from lists on Spotify since starting this campaign?
yeah, there's an article that I can't remember the publication. I can share it with you after. But yeah, they're saying they simply could not find musicians. They actually said five out of the six musicians they reached out to refused to talk, even anonymously with the publication, because they were fearful they were going to be punished by Spotify, specifically in regards to playlisting. Which speaks to the overwhelming power that Spotify has to determine who succeeds on their platform, right? As Liz Pelly, who you had on some weeks ago, has written about a lot, right? The power in Spotify are these playlists, and the process by which the playlists are created is extremely mysterious. You know, I think everyone assumes, just like radio and other aspects of the industry, there's pretty intimate connections between the major labels and between money and publicists and managers and whoever's making these decisions at Spotify. And it's some like pretty sinister cabal of major label players, Spotify data scientists, and like algorithms determining the future of music via these playlists. So it's very scary, and artists know how much power these things have. It's just like, as musicians, I think we a lot of us have had this experience. If you look at your Spotify numbers, where for whatever reason Spotify picks up one of your songs, and in like 2 days your, you know, monthly listeners like triples or quadruples for a month or something, because it's on this playlist, right? That's where all of the power is. So artists are fearful of upsetting this system that I think they rightfully recognize is being determined by these extremely powerful players. Just like in any other labor situation, the solution out of this is unity, right? Just like in any workplace, if you speak out on your own, you can be targeted and punished by the boss. But if you have a whole host of people speaking out at the same time, right, it's much more difficult for them to collectively punish you, right? This is the strength and collectively organizing, the importance of doing it this way. But as that article demonstrates, a lot of people are still fearful. And, you know, in doing our organizing, I think we've all run into people who have not wanted to sign, or who have, you know, responded to an email to support one of our campaigns, and they say, oh, I need to talk to my manager and I'll get back to you. And then they never respond to the email. Right. So there's definitely still a fear in this industry, because we don't have a union, right? We haven't collectively organized ourselves. So a lot of that fear still exists.
No, I think it's also true, right? Because it also in a way qualifies another one of your demands, namely this kind of demand for a degree of transparency, right? Because I think the opacity of these systems, you know, like the balance between the opacity of these systems and their power is really, really daunting. And even if, I mean, for example, you know, we've been pretty vocal on vocally kind of anti Spotify for a number of years. And I honestly don't check it enough. I've given up on it so much that like I wouldn't even tell if it is.
Have Spotify. I don't know what the playlists are.
Yeah, anyway, exactly. I wouldn't know if it had made a dent. But the point being is that like darkness breeds superstition too, right? I mean, which even if it weren't to be true that there's somebody there listening and you know, discriminating against someone on the basis of things that they've said, the fact that there would be no way to verify that is critique enough to level at these platforms.
But there has been plenty of research done in this area. I mean, I remember reading, maybe it was in this Spotify. Did you all ever read the book Spotify Takedown? Spotify Teardown?
Teardown, yeah.
It's this incredible book that was commissioned by the Swedish government to the tune of €1 million, yeah. Which is kind of amazing that Sweden paid €1 million to take down one of their biggest exports. But anyways, it's this really in-depth analysis of Spotify, the culture and how the algorithms work and everything. And I think it was in there where they were talking about how, you know, if you have in the kind of like most popular playlists, a kind of more male than female, vocally led kind of groups, then that tends to recommend something that sounds similar. And so that then just kind of like continues the bias towards male driven kind of music, and kind of further entrenches these kind of inequities in.
Yeah, but how would we know?
This is the because thing. Of these. The, yeah. This book.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah.
So that research does exist, but yeah, I mean, I think it would be great if this was a more kind of like widely understood phenomenon that was more, less opaque.
Yeah, sure. if it was some like very reasonable process, you'd think they would explain it better by now. And you know, the tools they roll out, like they did a few weeks ago, where they were suggesting a new program by which, you know, specific kind of targeting independent artists that they could we could receive sort of like playlist and algorithmic prioritization in exchange for accepting lower royalty rates, proves more or less that they can, you know, stack the deck in how their algorithm works. They're saying, hey, we'll give you that boost if you just take a pay cut, right? It's like, okay, so you're admitting that this is how this works effectively in this sense.
Totally. I thought that was really unwise on their behalf. I was like, you're just
but give them credit. This is the thing, is they're barefaced.
That's true.
Right? It's like, it's not unwise. It's really clever. You know, I mean, it's clever. It's not necessarily like positive. But yeah, it's like payola, but on credit, right? It's like,
but they're just like, they're
you
so
take a pay cut for preferential treatment. You don't have to necessarily be paying for it. You're just receiving less compensation for signing up to things. And they know it will work. That's the thing that bugs me about it, right? Is it's like this kind of two-sided marketplace thing that they've been pushing toward for quite some time. You know, they know fundamentally, I believe that they know at least that they'll end up making more money from artists attempting to, you know, roll the dice within this kind of opaque, they're setting up a gambling system ultimately, and they will end up making a lot of money from it.
Yeah, it's pretty classic monopoly capitalism, because they're the main player, right? And they can just say, hey, we're going to do this wild thing, we're going to reduce your royalty rates, and if you don't like it, what are you going to do about it? You know, there's nowhere else to go, essentially, is what they're saying. Yep. And they can do that because they have such a huge market share.
So maybe I want to ask you all both a little bit about your personal experience with this, because you play in a band together, you both play in multiple bands, but you both play in the band Downtown Boys, correct me if I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you've been releasing records and touring for a number of years. And I wonder, you know, beyond like, like taking off your organizer cap for a second, what has your experience been with Spotify and streaming? Did you have any, you know, and also not wanting to guess your age, but like, you know, was this a transitional thing for you, or is this something that you've always dealt with as working artists?
Yeah, I mean, we started Downtown Boys in 2012, so Spotify existed, but I don't remember really deeply thinking about it too much. At the same time, we don't have quite the same narrative as, like, you know, listen to your episode with Tom Gray the other day of this kind of transition where you were signing a lot of records to, like, you know, having to be increased dependency on other forms and on streaming and this sort of thing. I mean, we were a like band yelling about political issues in English and Spanish from Providence, Rhode Island. So I think from the beginning, we weren't quite expecting to like sell a ton of records and like do things in a certain way. And in fact, like getting some level of, you know, I don't know, sustainability economically to the band, I think was consistently surprising to us, which maybe says a lot of just around the economics of the industry, even when we first entered it. But it's sort of from the beginning, we made money entirely from touring. And that had really always been the case since we started. I don't think we've ever truly made money from selling many records as a band. So I think COVID was really a big reveal moment, because the touring was entirely stripped away. So like I was saying, that income source was entirely gone. So while we had never truly made a ton of money online or selling records, other than selling them in person on touring, it was suddenly like, hey, there's this whole other universe that we've sort of like just been participating in by default, that we didn't even think about, that is this online economy of Spotify that, you know, maybe we had been thinking about as a way to almost just promote concerts, but is actually making a lot of money for somebody. It's just not us. And so, and I think for musicians our age, that was the case for a lot of us.
Yeah, I agree. I'm trying to think of like when I first heard of Spotify or put my music on Spotify, and I'm just drawing a blank. I feel like one day one of my labels just put some songs up there. I'm like, okay, this is a thing now. And but it's not never even been like supplementary income. Like, it's just so little how much I get paid.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I mean, I don't even check. I think there was one time I got paid at like a decent royalty, and that was a fluke because I was opening for a much larger band, and so that was actually coming from like the larger kind of thing. But I don't really check my kind of official royalty checks, because it's always just, I don't know, it's just negligible. Like so negligible. It's not something that I ever even really consider into my like monthly budget. And that's, it shouldn't necessarily be like that, but I definitely came from like a similar mindset of what you mentioned, Joey, of just kind of like, oh, you know, my music is kind of outsider. I don't imagine I'm going to make money with it. So that when I did start to be able to make a living with it, it was almost felt like a miracle. And I was like, wow, this is incredible that I'm actually able to like live off of this. And I was so kind of grateful for that, that I didn't really even question the fact that the recorded material wasn't really being valued. And I think that that's this kind of very, disempowered position that a lot of independent artists are coming from, that we don't really kind of value the art that we're making. You know, I mean, I did value it, of course, like it's such an integral part to my life and to my identity, but I wasn't really putting like a monetary value on it. And I feel like that's something that I hope that your community organizing can help people understand, that it is actually valuable, not just to them personally, but also, you know, it has a monetary value.
Particularly in aggregate, yeah.
In aggregate, it is what makes Spotify worth so many billions of dollars, because everybody's involved in it. And without everybody, it wouldn't be as valuable.
Yeah. No, I fully agree. And you put it very clearly that, when you're starting off in the industry, you don't even think about it. And we're working, you know, 12, 13, 14 hours a day on music, touring, performing. But, you know, especially when you're first starting, you don't even consider that you should be compensated properly for that work. You know, I remember in Downtown Boys, when you're in the early years, like playing a show at Death by Audio, and I think at the end of the night we made like $300, you know, split like six ways, and that was like the most we had ever made. I remember thinking, yeah. Oh my god, like, you know, this is crazy, you're getting paid so much for this show. You know, we moved a bit from there to where it became somewhat financially sustainable to have this band for a few years before COVID hit. But yeah, I mean, I think that's a lot of the purpose with our organization, and to get back to the name of the organization, right? Union of Musicians and Allied Workers, right? That workers part is a key. And in a lot of our text and press statements and everything we say, instead of saying musician, we often say music worker. Part of that's to include like everyone in the music industry, but part of it is to reframe this discussion that, yeah, we're workers. And as workers, we need to be compensated, and to switch that both to like outwardly, but like you're saying, inwardly too, to identify as workers, as musicians. And I think COVID has revealed this concept even further, because after we were all out of work, all unable to make our rent payments, in the US, you know, musicians had always been cut out of most, even the small number of benefits, public benefits programs that we have here. And all of a sudden musicians were realizing, hey, we're in the same boat right now as all of these other workers in this country. We also can't access healthcare, just like Uber drivers can't access healthcare and can't access unemployment benefits, just like, you know, stagehands can't access all of this stuff. So I think the pandemic created these conditions where, yeah, musicians are finally beginning to understand in a serious way that our interests as workers are tied up in the interests of all of the other workers in our society, particularly other gig workers, and that we do need to unite so that we can unite with those other workers to push for, you know, meaningful public changes also.
You're listening to the free version of this podcast. If you would like to hear the full version and support this series, please visit patreon.com/interdependence. This podcast is ad-free and only possible through patron support. Thank you.